Hey, everybody, it's Kai. This is the Corner Office Podcast. Before we get going, let me just say thank you to those of you who subscribed to this podcast and left us reviews and rated us on iTunes. It does actually help with the internal machinations of iTunes. Your support does absolutely mean a lot to us, and we appreciate that. So thank you for that. And now let us get to today's episode of Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
You might find yourself in the next couple of weeks in a department store, maybe not right outside Dallas like this one, but you know what I mean. And as you check off that holiday shopping list, take a minute to notice the layout of the store and the kinds of merchandise they've got stocked and how it's displayed. Because for today's episode of Corner Office, I'm talking to a guy who thinks about that stuff all the time. It's his job. Marvin Ellison is the CEO of JCPenney. He's been there for about 16 months. July of 2015 is how long he's had the job. And when he was hired, He had some work to do. He had to get the company back in order, so to speak, to get JCPenney to profitability, or to put it another way, to undo the damage that CEO Ron Johnson did when he ran the company from late November of 2011 to January of 2013. Johnson, as you might remember, came from Apple. He was the guy who helped Steve Jobs do the Apple stores. Penny hired him to do, in essence, the same thing with JCPenney. And if you think about that juxtaposition, it's kind of interesting. Didn't work out so well. Former CEO Mike Ullman had to come back and run the company for a while the board looked for a new CEO. That CEO was Marvin Ellison, and I was talking to him in Dallas the other day. Here it is.
We're in the Stonebriar Mall at our JCPenney store. Great store closest to the office. So
you're here all the time?
Unfortunately for them, yes.
They know you when you walk in?
They do. All the associates know us pretty well. So we try not to overburden them, but unfortunately we tend to overburden them.
Well, then I apologize for the overburden. When you walk into a store, not this one, but like in Ames, Iowa, for instance, what are you looking for?
Well, I typically walk in with no reports. I walk in with no documents. I typically walk in with a little small notebook that I take notes in, and I look at observations. I observe the customers and how our associates are interacting with them. I observe if the store is set to kind of where we should be seasonally. I observe the customer's interaction to the product. I'm not one to start to come in to talk about sales versus plan or gross profit in this category. Mm-hmm. You know, we have really talented people, and they do that very well. My job is to come in to be the cultural ambassador to make sure that we're giving the stores what they need. We have a philosophy. We come in to take lists, not leave lists. So I don't come in to give a ton of direction. I come in to ask, what can we do to make the work environment better? So I usually leave with a long list and rarely leave them with a long list.
Does the staff know you when you walk in? I mean, is your picture up in the break room or something?
Unfortunately, it is. So they tend to know me, but, you know, I typically walk in with a name badge on.
Right.
It's just one of my philosophies because I'm an associate just like the rest of the team, and I don't think there is a delineation between me and the guy or the gal that's unloading the truck back there. So we try to keep it in perspective.
Since we're talking about what you're wearing a Penny brand, right?
I am. I'm wearing a Collection by Strahan suit. I think it's a Strahan tie and shoes.
Michael Strahan?
Yeah, Michael Strahan. You know, the
football player.
Football player, recent Hall of Famer. Yep. You know,
and TV guy.
He's on a lot of TV, man. He's on a lot of Good TV. Morning America. He does the $10,000 pyramid, and he's also on Fox Sports with the NFL.
Why is it important that you wear the store brand?
Well, I think it sends a message that what we sell is good enough for everyone. If it's good enough for the hardworking men and women to come in here to buy it, if it's good enough for the associates that work here and to use their employee discount to purchase it, then it's good enough for me and the management team. So it's a very simple mandate. Whenever anyone from the corporate office steps foot in a store for an official visit, they must wear JCPenney clothing. It's just a minimum expectation. And by the way, a couple of years ago when I started, that was not the case. Right. It was not uncommon to see someone walking here with designer brands on, which made no sense to me because we should reflect. And again, we should be the brand ambassadors of the company. And also, I'm a good consumer. I can provide consumer feedback to the merchant team.
And it looks good. I mean, you wear it well, right? What's the biggest difference between Penny today with you here and Penny, you know, with Ron Johnson in charge?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things. Number one, you have to know who you are and what you stand for as a business. That sounds so very simple. But I think there's a lot of confusion around what is JCPenney as a brand, and what consumer are we trying to serve? And so I think there's a lot more clarity today than, you know, 2+ years ago.
Explain that a little bit. I mean, who is your consumer, and what are you trying to do now?
Well, I think one of the big mistakes we've made in the past is that we had a core consumer, very traditional, you know, what I call Middle America consumer, and we want to move away from that. We want to go to more progressive, kind of millennial type of consumer, and so we changed our brands. We changed the fit and fabric. We tried to make the store a little bit hipper to attract a more younger, kind of more millennial type customer, and it fell pretty miserably. And when you look at the data is pretty compelling. Over 70% of our customers are female, which was not a big surprise. Yeah. But when you take that female percent, 55% is on average about 60 years old.
Half your customers are women more than 60 years old.
Yeah. And that, you know, 60 years old, kids moved out of the house, homeowner, kind of a traditional customer, enjoys traditional types of media. But then the other 45% is in her early 30s. She's very multicultural. She has on average 2 children, and she lives her life through social media. And so we have these 2 very different customers, yet we were trying to serve, you know, a customer that didn't was not really interested in shopping with us. And so now we have a strategy where we're leveraging our marketing, our media, to communicate to 2 different customers, but they have some common fundamental things that they both want.
There's a great quote from you that I read about data. You're a big data guy.
Yeah.
Right? You want to know what the sales data says. And, you know, you had said in this quote, we tried intuition for 18 months and it didn't work. We're not doing that anymore. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a combination. I call it art and science. You know, you can never get away from the art, because art is the
art of retail.
Art of retail. It's intuition. I've been in retail for over 30 years. It's the intuition you gain over a period of time. We have great merchants, and they have a great eye, have, you know, great instincts on what will and won't sell. But in today's environment, there's so much rich data available. If you can combine the intuition and the data analysis, you have a really compelling decision-making ability. And we were leaning totally on intuition, totally on, you know, philosophy, and we were not looking at the data. And now we're trying to, you know, do a combination of both.
All right, so let's walk a little bit. Sure. I want you to tell me what you're seeing as we go by, since this is your store and yeah. You're running a place. So we're heading through like jewelry and accessories.
Yeah,
right?
Well, one of the things that we've done here is that we have this wonderful Sephora partnership.
Yep.
And it's our fastest growing
makeup
business.
And skincare. And
it
all
is. It's a fabulous business. We have a great partnership with Sephora. The problem is that the surrounding areas, you know, adjacent to Sephora, did not connect with that same younger, more millennial customer. This is for that emerging, you know, multicultural younger female right. consumer. And this area was not conducive. So we reset this entire area. We call it center core. So It's the center of the store, and we reset it so it can have a more aesthetic feel that Sephora doesn't feel like an oasis in the middle of a desert.
So now we've got women's workout gear here. We've got jewelry and accessories, right?
Yeah, and part of what we've done here is that we moved this is more casual up front because we're traditional. We're not, you know, we're not afraid of that. We're not trying to run away from that, but also America is becoming more casual. And so we've kind of reshifted, and we moved more of our casual, more active wear closer to the front. And this brand is a private brand for us, only sold exclusively at JCPenney. Exergen is one of our fastest growing brands in the entire store.
So when you sit in the front office and you issue this directive that says basically fix this, how closely entwined are you with the decision to move women's workout gear closer to Sephora?
Well, it's a great question. So it really comes down to getting the consumer feedback and understanding consumer trends. When the trends were pretty clear that data that the active wear was really growing fast, and that the consumer was becoming more casual. When we just took a quick view of our store, I mean, we were not set that way. So the question was, how do we set our store to be more in line with consumer trends? And so we took about 10 or 15 stores, and we decided to just kind of reset this area and moving apparel in a way where active was closer to the front, and we measured the results. When the results came in positive, then we started to make the shift for the whole company. So it's a test-and-learn environment rather than just saying, let's do it because we think the data points us in that direction. We take a subset of stores, we We change them. We test them. We compare the test data to a control set of stores. And if the data proves out, then that gives us confidence to move more stores. That's what we did in this case.
You're doing better sales and revenue-wise than you have in the past number of years, but you're still not making money, right? Oh, look at that. All right, so now you're picking up a what is that? That's like reindeer.
This is, yeah. This
you
is.
You got to police the store, right?
Well, I'm an associate, and no job is too small, no job is too large. Well, we are, but here's the challenge. The challenge is the reason we're not making money is because of the debt burden. So when Mike Allman came back after Ron Johnson left the company, Mike was the previous CEO. He had to create enough liquidity that the company could operate effectively.
Right.
So we had to take on a significant amount of debt. And so when I arrived, we had an interest payment north of $400 million a year. And so if you think about that, that's an extra expense that the 2 years prior did not exist. And so that is the burden that we're getting over. Here's the good news. The good news is when we hit our forecast for the fourth quarter, we'll end the year at profitable earnings. That'll be the first time since, I think, 2010. So it's a significant improvement in the company. And that's going to happen in 2016. So JCPenney will end 2016 in the black, so to speak. So we'll be profitable, and then we'll build from there.
What can't you do because of the losses and the problems that Ron Johnson brought this company?
There's not a lot we can't do. I mean, we have over $2 billion in liquidity, so we're in a really good position from a access to cash. We are generating positive cash flow. We paid down $500 million in debt last year. We're planning to pay off more than that in 2016. And so we have this schedule where we're paying the debt down, and we are projecting in the next couple of years our debt to EBITDA ratio will be better than it's been, in over 10 years. So we're on a pathway. So we just have to be smart. I can't and I wouldn't go out and spend, an enormous amount of capital building new stores or spending it erroneously. So we have to be really smart with our capital because we're kind of on this little bit of restrictive spending so that we can get in line with a debt to equity, debt to EBITDA, and a positive net earnings. So there's not a lot of restrictions. We're just being very smart, not making a bunch of decisions that we can't validate with data and with test and learn environments.
It's worth a note here. You've got plus or minus 1,100 stores, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
You happy with that number? Or do you have to be happy with that number?
No, I don't. We're evaluating. It's something we evaluate every year. It's important for us to understand that we're in what I call an omnichannel environment.
Omnichannel.
It's a combination of how do you leverage your .com e-commerce platform with your physical brick and mortar stores, and so we are in the process of trying to determine what is the right number of stores for JCPenney to serve customers in the way they want to be served. And today, we are now leveraging our brick and mortar stores for distribution of e-commerce transactions.
Mm-hmm. And buy it online and pick it up here.
Exactly. So exiting the third quarter, 40% of all of our e-commerce sales were picked up in the store. And also within that quarter, almost 60% of all e-commerce sales touched the store in some shape, form, or fashion. So the stores are an important equation to the future of retail. And the question is, what is the right number of stores? And we're in the process of determining that over the next couple of years.
So retail's changing, right? I mean, everybody's in it now. Clothing, Amazon's going to be the biggest clothing seller in the country and in the world probably soon. And y'all are going after sort of a share of a dwindling market. How do you do that?
Well, I think you got to define dwindling. So we're going to end the year close to 13.
Well, we want to spend less, right? We consumers want to spend less money. We want cheaper stuff. We're distracted by everything else that's going on out there, right, with electronics and games and society and you name it. How do you get people to pay attention to what it is that you're doing for a living?
Well, I think at the end of the day, people will always respond to a value. Value is not defined as cheap.
This is really funny because I'm looking up here saying 50 to 70% off, 50 to 70% off. There's clearance signs and all this stuff.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, it's...
But it's all part of the value equation. Meaning, how can you convince a consumer that they can get more for their dollar shopping in your environment versus another environment? How can you convince a consumer that the quality of your product is such that it should drive more loyalty than the next channel. Well, that channel is brick and mortar or online. So I believe whether it's today, 100 years ago, 100 years in the future, we'll always respond to value. I think we'll always respond to a seamless, convenient way to shop. You know, everyone believed that, you know, e-commerce would destroy, you know, brick and mortar retail. I think to the opposite, because if you look at what is happening, more of the pure play e-commerce companies are looking for brick and mortar locations so that they can understand, you know, a better cross relationship. The biggest challenge that e-commerce companies will have, and so will brick and mortar companies who have e-commerce platforms, is how do you address the increasing shipping cost that is currently in place? And you can't find me one e-commerce retailer that does not have shipping costs as their number one growing expense. And so how do you manage that? And we think the best way to manage it is by having a physical footprint of stores where customers can conveniently buy something and pick it up. That gives them the ability to still come into a store, but also gives them the ability to have a quick, seamless, and cheap way to pick something up versus kind of the model that exists today. This is an iterative learning process, but we think consumers will spend if you give them a great value, give them great quality, and you give them good service, and you give them simplicity. And so that's what we're trying to create within this environment.
This is your second Black Friday, right, as CEO?
Yes, sir.
What'd you learn the first time through that you're doing different this time?
Great question. I think the thing we learned last time,
because we should say you underperformed a little bit, right? You weren't real happy with how you performed.
No, we were very pleased.
Were you?
Yeah, we were. We had, if you look at our comparative sales number for the fourth quarter of last year, I mean, we were roughly, I think, 4.1%. That was the best in the industry, and that was coming off a very strong Black Friday. So we were relatively pleased. What we learned is we believed that it was important to have a more simple message. So you're going to see us talk a lot about gifts under $20, gifts under $15. So simplify the message to the consumer. We also learned that we, you know, probably needed to have more giftable items, items that a customer could easily pick up and turn it into a gift for a family member or for a loved one. And we decided that we wanted to get into a category that was bigger ticket. So we rolled out appliance showrooms to over 500 stores.
I was going to ask you about appliances because are you becoming Sears here? Is that what's going on? What data point do you have that says we need to have side-by-side refrigerators and ranges on our second floor here?
It's a couple interesting data points. So in America, 100,000.
Well, there are data points. Look at this.
Absolutely. Yeah. In America, 100,000 appliances break every day. Every day.
No, really?
Every day. Think about it. Every home
it feels
has,
like they're all in my house, but that's a whole different thing.
Every home, I feel the same way. Every home has a dishwasher, refrigerator, washer, dryer, you know, microwave, oven, range. And so 100,000 break every day. It is, and the data shows that the appliance category, because of innovation, new home building, and home turnover, is going to grow, you know, at over, you know, 5% over the next 3 years. And when we ran the data, and this is called a failed search analysis. So we went to jcpenney.com and we looked at all the searches that customers put in for items that we didn't carry, and at the top of the list was major appliances.
Wow.
So customers were coming to jcpenney.com searching for appliances, and we didn't have it. And then we asked our customers, you know, would you buy appliances from us? And they said yes, if the brands were appropriate, if the prices were right, and if there was a service guarantee on quality. And so we think we've addressed all those things, and it's been a significant success for us.
No-brainer for you, really?
Well, I spent a lot of years, you know, in a previous life working in the appliance business as well as other things. So I understood it relatively well. We've got some really talented people on board. We've got three great suppliers with Samsung, LG, and GE, and it's been a tremendous success for us.
Since you mentioned previous life, Home Depot, Target, you started in you were a security guard, for crying out loud, at Target.
I started out a part-time security guard making $4.35 an hour.
So when you know, the 25-year-old Marvin Ellison looked ahead and said, here's what I'm going to be doing, was this it?
Well, I love retail because I love the people interaction. I love the ability to make a change and see the result, you know, kind of in real time. I had aspirations, but to tell you that at 25 years old, I circled JCPenney, chairman, CEO, as the ultimate goal, that would not be the case. I circle, you know, continuous improvement, and growth in the industry, and I've been just very blessed to end up here, and we're having a lot of fun trying to get this great company turned around.
Who's your competition?
Well, it's a broad category because of the different categories products that we sell. But I would say for the most part, it would be, you know, department store retailers that are kind of in the value-oriented space. And then if you look online,
So is that like Macy's, TJ Maxx? Who is that?
It could be all of them because, you know, in certain categories of women's apparel, you would say Macy's could be a very strong competitor. In certain categories of home, you could say that Home Goods can be a competitor. In certain categories of just basic goods, you could say that Kohl's could be a competitor. So it just depends. And those are all outstanding companies that we learn a lot from, and you know, and also that we're competing with every day to get a share of the consumer's wallet.
What keeps you up at night?
My wife of 25 years will tell you that I sleep like a baby. I'm a guy. I don't worry about a lot. I'm a guy of strong religious faith. I just believe you know, build a good plan, hire great people, and everything within your control, you focus on that. The things I don't control, I don't spend a ton of time worrying about them. I'm very cognizant of them, but I'm not a big worrier. The thing that occupies the most of my mind share would be, what can we do to get this company fully turned around so that the over 100,000 associates have a great place to work and we can continue to attract customers that are interested in shopping at our stores and our website. So that's really, it's the ongoing process of trying to create a value proposition where people will respond to.
You made some changes coming in here, right? Because you get to do that because you're the man now. What has not changed since the Ron Johnson days? I mean, what, other than the debt and the lost jobs and the problems, what good did he bring?
I think the one thing that happened in that era is there was a lot of capital spent to refresh and upgrade the store environment. And so I think it was undebatable that the stores were a little tired, were a little old and worn, and from a decor standpoint, were not as fresh. So a lot of capital was spent on improving the store environment, and I think that really helped JCPenney to have a brighter, more aesthetically pleasing image inside the stores.
Did you have any hesitation about taking this job, given where the company was when you came here?
Yeah, I did. But after I conducted a lot of research and leveraged some good partners in other, you know, industries to give me some insight, I came to a realization that I couldn't find another public company this size that had gone through the same level of financial downturn driven solely by poor leadership decisions. It was not an economic downturn. This was post-recession. There was not a disruptive competitor. There was not a massive new change in technology. The revenue decline was driven by poorly thought-out strategic decisions. And so my perspective was pretty simple. If poor leadership decisions drove the revenue decline, if we could recruit a talented team, put together a really strong strategic plan, and elevate the focus on data, intuition, and leadership, then maybe we could get it turned around. And so for me, that was attractive because I felt leadership really caused it to perform poorly. Could good leadership bring it back?
How much do you pay attention, as long as you brought up the idea of this being a publicly traded company, how much do you pay attention to the market and analyst calls and stock price and, you know, all that noise, I guess?
Well, it's important. I mean, we are, as you said, we're a publicly traded company. We have shareholders. We have a board of directors. And we're responsible to serve, you know, those constituencies in a way. And when someone buys a share of stock, it's personal to me that we need to find a way to make it their best investment in their portfolio. But it is my responsibility and the board's responsibility to build strategic plans, not for the quarterly call, but for the long-term financial benefit of the company. And so we balance, you know, meeting the week and the month and the quarter with what is in the best interest strategically of JCPenney. So it's important to me, but again, the board has given me and provided me the confidence and the support to go out and make sure we're making the right long-term decisions.
Are you optimistic about the American economy?
I am. I am. I'm very optimistic. If you look at all of the relevant, you know, macro data points that really point to strength or weakness. Savings rates are good. Wages are stable, if not up. Unemployment is solid. Home ownership is high. Home appreciation is high. But consumer confidence for the last couple months has been a little wavering. And I think it's a lot to do with a lot of things. And we're hoping now that we're in the holiday season, I call it a natural spending time frame where people just spend. I mean, the American consumer wants to spend. They have the capacity to spend. I think it's incumbent on the retailers to give them a reason to spend. And so for JCPenney and for other retailers, we have to do a better job in providing a compelling reason for someone to get off the couch, come in and shop, or get off the couch and log in to buy something. And so the ownership and the onus is on us. I think the consumers out there, we just have to attract them in a more effective way.
Without getting too political about it, what's your level of attention that you're paying to uncertainty in this economy with the change in administration?
I think it's very high. I mean, you know, we're, as I've said many times, I mean, we're a company that does not necessarily get involved in the political process. Our customers are progressive, conservatives, and independents, and we love them all. But politically and policy wise, I mean, we pay close attention. We pay close attention to Secretary Clinton's platform and Mr. Trump, President-elect's platform, and we were ready to pivot and to respond accordingly. And so we're paying very close attention. We'll see how President-elect Trump builds out his administration, and we'll be more than willing and more than able to respond accordingly to whatever policies that he and the Congress put forth.
How do you prepare? What's your thought process?
The tough thing for any business is, you know, understanding the campaign versus the administration. I mean, we don't know. I mean, so we're like every other business or every other American. We are just waiting to see what happens with the formation of his cabinet and what will happen when he's sworn in and what his priorities will be. So it's just a big wait and see right now.
So in theory, if he does this infrastructure spending program that he wants, right, and he does drive economic growth, that you're all for that. That's a positive.
That's a positive. It's a positive for JCPenney. It's a positive for the USA. And so we see those things as positive, but we're waiting and seeing. I mean, we understand that a campaign and the actual platform, you know, they have to be worked through and modified. And so we're just waiting and seeing like every other business, every other American, but we're going to remain nimble and flexible, and we'll be able to respond accordingly.
5 years from now, if we come back and do this interview in this store, first of all, what physically is it going to look like? Is it going to look the same? And then what's this company going to look like?
I think the store will look relatively the same. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to put more of an emphasis on beauty, which will be our Sephora and our InStyle salon business. We're trying to put more of an emphasis on home refresh, you know, whether that's appliances or furniture or whether that's, you know, windows and just different things to help a customer who wants things done for her. And we want to put a big emphasis on value. And so will the apparel section look the same? Will it be more or less? I don't know. Yeah. I know that we're spending a lot of time trying to figure out how a customer shops and laying out the store in a more conducive way. So I would say the store footprint may look a little different, but we expect to be here, be vibrant, and we expect to be taking market share.
I notice you always say her when you talk about your consumer, your customer.
Yeah.
Just because that's the fact.
Well, it's the fact. It's over, I said, over 70% are female, and she drives the majority of the purchases in the household. When she comes in to buy a dress for herself, when she comes in to shop in Sephora, she'll typically buy for her kids and her husband. Now, what is interesting is that we've noticed that in the last couple of years, men have become more self-driven to buy for themselves. One of our strongest businesses has been men's apparel, and we're finding that over the last 2 years, it's interesting that more men are coming in and purchasing clothing for themselves than 2 years prior. So that's an interesting transition we've seen the last couple of years.
You buy your own clothes?
I do.
For real?
I do. I buy my own clothes, and then when my wife purchases clothes, she always does a better job.
Marvin, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, so that's it for my conversation with Marvin Ellison, CEO of JCPenney. That was from the JCPenney at Stonebriar Mall in Frisco, Texas, a little bit north of Dallas. Another episode of Corner Office is coming in a couple of weeks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll talk to you next time.